This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The Supreme Court's ruling in the Dobbs case didn't come as any surprise. In fact, given the draft opinion that was leaked in May, overturning Roe v. Wade was nearly a certainty. But the effects have been rapid and chaotic. In some states, abortions stopped overnight. In others, there's confusion about what kinds of maternal care might now be potentially criminal. And the response from Democrats in Washington struck many supporters of abortion rights as painfully inadequate. Gia Tolentino and Stefania Telladrid have both reported extensively on the issue. They spoke this week with New Yorker senior editor Tyler Foggett on the podcast Politics and More. Stefania had returned from the state of Texas, where she was in an abortion clinic in Houston exactly when the Dobbs decision was announced.
The decision came shortly after 9 a.m., and several members of the staff were kind of huddled in the front desk area. And the reactions were dramatic. I mean, people started crying. People were just in complete disbelief of what was happening. And then at some point, a patient comes up to the clinic director and says, you know, why are you all crying? And then she kind of had to put herself together and swipe away her tears and go up to the patients who were waiting in the waiting room and say, ladies, the Supreme Court just struck down Roe v. Wade, meaning that we can no longer operate as an abortion clinic, and we will not be able to assist you today. And I was struck by a Cuban woman who spoke no English, and she couldn't really understand what was happening. And at one point, she turns to the clinic director and says, you know, ¿qué pasó? What did just happen? And then someone explained to her what had happened, and then she just left. And many of the other patients, the minute that the decision was announced, they just fled the clinic.
Because they were worried about getting in trouble just for being there?
Potentially. I mean, who knows? There are just so many reasons why that could have been. And to me, you know, what was most striking was just seeing kind of the enormous distance separating what was happening in D.C. and the reality on the ground.
So, Gia, you grew up in Texas. Can you talk a little bit about the cultural attitudes toward abortion that you observed, you know, long before this?
Yeah. I grew up in Texas, in Houston, actually, where the clinic that Stefania just visited is located. And I don't think I knew a single person that was not anti-abortion until I went to college, really. But I also think that the anti-abortion movement that has entrenched itself in half the country and that has become victorious in half the country is one that is significantly, markedly more extreme than the one that was dominant in the 80s and the 90s. This is an anti-abortion movement that has been as radicalized as the GOP has since 2016. There are at least 11 states that have no exceptions for rape and incest, which is previously, I mean, an unthinkable level of extremity and cruelty. And so the people that I grew up around, they talked about abortion as murder. You know, there was this doctrine that life begins at conception, that abortion is killing a baby. But I think that when it really came down to it, abortion was not actually instinctively tantamount to murder. There was an understanding that there was a loss in abortion, but that there was not actually a reason why you would deny a pregnant person chemotherapy because she was pregnant, right? That you would refuse someone care for a septic uterus because you would have to stop the fetus's heartbeat first. I think that the true implications of fetal personhood, which is what this current anti-abortion movement has organized itself around, you know, the idea that effectively the fetus is a kind of person with rights that are not only equal to, but really far superior to any that any of us enjoy, you know, the right to make someone die so that you can live. That is significantly more extreme than any of what I grew up around. And that was already quite extreme.
Yeah, it seems like there's been a real shift. Like, I was thinking about SB 8, which is the Texas law that banned abortion after 6 weeks of pregnancy. You know, that allows private citizens to go after abortion providers and people who aid and abet those seeking an abortion, like the Uber driver who takes you to the clinic. But that law technically doesn't hold the person who got the abortion liable. And then in 2014, Tennessee passed what was the first law in the United States to allow women to be prosecuted for drug use during pregnancy. But even that was discontinued after a couple of years. So it seems like there has been sort of a hesitation up until this point to actually go after the women who are getting the abortions, even if, you know, you're indirectly going after them by making it harder for them to get the procedure. But now you're seeing in states like, you know, Wyoming, that they're looking to pass their own versions of the Tennessee law. So basically going after women for this idea of fetal endangerment. And so I'm wondering if you guys have any thoughts on, like, the exact point at which the pro-life movement pivoted to the criminalization of people who are getting abortions or pregnant people rather than going after the doctors or the people who are sort of surrounding the procedure.
So it's true that currently the anti-abortion movement is sticking to the idea that, you know, there will be need for wayward mothers. But this, I have a strong feeling, is a veil that will fall soon enough, right? Because progressive states are passing laws that will shield women and doctors from out-of-state prosecutions to block medical records, et cetera. And once you can't target people out of state, once you can't target doctors effectively for providing abortions, the only people to target to stop abortions will really be the people who are getting them. And there are a lot of people who have felt quite surprised by this, where in fact, the people in the reproductive rights community in Texas, for example, have known that this moment was coming with absolute certainty, I would say, since about 2011, when the Texas state bans began passing that were then replicated in so many other states around the country. And in terms of the criminalization of pregnancy, the National Advocates for Pregnant Women have done, like, uniquely valuable work on this. There's been a myriad of charges. There's child endangerment. There's possession and distribution of narcotics to a minor. You know, there's manslaughter charges in some cases of stillbirth, even when no causal link could be drawn between the actions of the pregnant person and the stillbirth itself, right? This has been a tactic that has been tested on low-income women, on brown and black women since the 80s, really. I would say that's when it really started. There were hospitals in South Carolina that were drug testing women at labor secretly and then charging them. And it has been pretty successful because even those of us who have defended reproductive rights have tended to think of these cases as outliers. And I think we are in an era now when we will see they were not the outliers. They experienced what is coming for a lot more people.
So how hard is it to distinguish between an abortion and a miscarriage? Is this the kind of thing where a doctor can step in and say this is, you know, very obviously an unintentional miscarriage rather than an intentional abortion?
You know, so abortion and miscarriage are both incredibly common. Both occur about a million times per year. And in many cases, they're clinically indistinguishable. If a woman's uterus expels its contents, there is no sort of instant test to distinguish whether it was a deliberate miscarriage or a natural one. And on the one hand, this is helpful for people who will be seeking abortions and getting them. There is no obligation for them to walk into an urgent care facility and say, I took misoprostol and I think I might be bleeding too much and I would like to have an exam. They don't need to do that. And in fact, they should not. However, what that also means is that women who are experiencing miscarriage naturally, who walk into an urgent care center and say, I miscarried, I'm at 12 weeks, and I think I might be bleeding too much, under certain hospitals, under certain district attorneys' jurisdictions, that miscarriage can and will be investigated as a possible crime, as the possible crime of abortion. So the indistinguishability of these two incredibly common events, on the one hand, it is a shield for women seeking abortions, and on the one hand, it is a cudgel towards women who miscarry.
And how do you expect this to affect the care that pregnant women receive?
What all of these restrictions do is they present a legal framework for charging and detaining women for doing anything that could possibly cause a miscarriage, that could be seen to cause early labor, to cause a stillbirth. It will have an incredibly chilling effect on prenatal care in prohibition states. You know, right now, most of the charges for child endangerment while pregnant have come from drug use, but there are plenty of other things that pregnant women are told they are not allowed to do because it will endanger the baby, like taking hot baths and exercising too much and eating deli turkey and all of these things, traveling, you know, working a certain kind of job. The inevitable effect is to set people in an adversarial relationship with their own pregnancy, which has happened in states like Tennessee with things like the fetal assault law, which was discontinued precisely because it caused an increase in maternal and infant death. You will see many, many, many stories of people who experience pregnancy complications, and the doctor will need to do hours of judicial review to make sure that they can't get sued for providing any procedure that might endanger the fetus, and women will die because of it. I mean, flat out, women will die in the course of ordinary pregnancy because of physician fears of doing anything that might make them liable for felony charges of performing an abortion. It will make pregnancy significantly more dangerous for many, many people.
You mentioned that this is a win for the Republicans, but I'm wondering to what extent this is, you know, more a failure of the Democratic Party that sort of had a chance to enshrine abortion rights in law and didn't take the opportunity. Do you guys have thoughts on sort of how the Democrats failed to respond to the threat to abortion rights in the Biden administration and, you know, even before that?
Oh, I have so many thoughts about this. I have thoughts about this that, you know, I think would require a lot of bleeping. I'm not enamored of Democratic Party leadership and can't think of a single time in my lifetime when I have felt that way. But when the decision came down and we saw what the Democratic Party leadership had to offer, that was a moment for me where I began to genuinely suspect for the first time in my life that actually the Democrats are not interested at all in protecting the right to abortion. It was presented on the day as nothing but a reason to get people to donate. And that I found so abominable. You know, that repro activists have been preparing for this moment for a decade. We knew for a fact that it was going to happen in 2018 once Kavanaugh was confirmed, and then an extra layer of absolutely this is going to happen with Amy Coney Barrett. The Democrats have sat by even before this, while abortion was basically made inaccessible to poor and minority women in many states in the South and Southeast over the last decade. Every candidate campaigns on making Roe the law of the land, and then as soon as they get elected, they back away and focus on things that they consider more important. You know, I'm sure, Stefania, you've seen it in your reporting. The people that we've been in contact with who have been laying the systems of protection in place, just these tiny threads of connection and support person to person with so little funding, with so little anything other than the will to help people. And so much risk to themselves. The way that they have been doing this for years, you know, I mean, I wasn't expecting the Democrats to, you know, override the filibuster and codify Roe if they weren't going to do it for the Voting Rights Act. But I've been, as you can tell, I've been incensed about it.
And it was interesting, as Gia pointed out, the main message that we got from the president that day was Roe was on the ballot, right? And I think the reaction for a lot of people was, how can you be telling me that the answer is to vote when we already voted you into office, right? I mean, you're there. And it was interesting to see that after the decision was announced, I went up to a small rally that several of the staff members at the clinic attended. And people were rightly upset. And they were, you know, shouting, bands off our buddies and we won't go back and fuck Greg Abbott, the governor of Texas. And then at one point, Beto O'Rourke showed up. And, You know, there were some among the crowd who wanted to hear from him. The majority did not. And then the chant became, "Democrats, we call your bluff." And, you know, what was good to see was that instead of running away from that criticism or just, you know, going on CNN and finding another kind of podium, Beto stayed. And he listened to people's abortion stories. And he wasn't hoping to co-opt that moment and to, you know, take the mic away from the women and the pregnant people who were hoping to express their anger and their frustration and their fear, frankly, for their lives and those of their generations to come. But he stayed and he listened as a way to show to them, you know, I'm here and I stand with you. And within the party itself, we've heard proposals to build abortion clinics on federal land, to fund people seeking abortions out of state, to expand the Supreme Court's membership, right? And in a way, I think it's been quite underwhelming to see that the White House's response has been, well, we'll protect the right to seek medical care. And we stand with the Attorney General, who has said that no state can interfere with a woman's ability to travel to another state. We have yet to see whether that's true or not. But then that doesn't solve the issue of what happens to those who cannot afford to travel anywhere else, right? You'll have to spend all of your savings or the money that you don't even have to get an abortion out of state. I mean, it's just completely insane. We did a story on a family from Dallas who had to travel from Dallas to New Mexico to a city called Santa Teresa so that their eighth grader could get an abortion. And the family had $1,500 left in savings. They just put in a down payment for a house that they had worked pretty much their entire lives to be able to afford. And they were suddenly faced with a cost of $1,300 to get an abortion. And I followed this family. I met them at the clinic in New Mexico, and I followed them back to Texas. And just the sense of anxiety, the dread, and the fear, genuine fear, of thinking, you know, where do we go from here? We have $200 left in our savings account. This just completely depleted our savings.
I mean, what we're talking about here is the ability to make a life. And I don't mean, I'm not talking about fetal life. There is perhaps no more fundamental issue to even to any sort of human autonomy, to the narrative control of your aspirations, to the fulfillment of your hopes, to your ability to feed your family, to your education, to everyone else's lives in your family and your community. It's at the nexus of every single issue, because every person, we are all the product of reproductive decisions or the lack of them. The population's ability to make free choices and to live in ways that are decent and abundant and loving and free. And there's nothing that breaks that desire and that ability like pregnancy before you're ready or when you're not able. Stefania, I'm sure you've had a lot of friends texting you. It's like, what can I do? What can I do?
Right.
Because there's too much to do. There's too much. It feels really overwhelming. And I keep telling people, just, you know, remember all of these things are connected. All these forms of justice are connected. And if you find one thread to pull and just keep pulling it, you know, that's what we have to do.
Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Gia Tolentino and Stefania Tulledreed. They spoke with Tyler Foggett, who's a senior editor at The New Yorker. There's more from their conversation on our podcast, Politics and More, and you can read all of our coverage on the overturning of Roe v. Wade at newyorker.com.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Patrick Radden-Keefe is a staff writer and really one of the best writers out there on crime, corruption, and misdeeds of all kinds. In one of our earliest stories on the Radio Hour, Patrick introduced us to the informants who put the drug kingpin El Chapo in U.S. prison. Patrick has just published a collection called Rogues, True Stories of Grifters, Killers, Rebels, and Crooks. And in the book, he tells the story of a woman named Astrid Hohleder and how she helped bring down a gangster who was her brother. Crime for the Hohleders was always close at hand.
Most of the men that I know from my family are dead. I could name not many people that are still alive that I used to know because they were shot.
Hohleder grew up in an Amsterdam neighborhood that's called Jordaan. It's gentrified now with galleries and Airbnbs. But when she grew up, it was big families in narrow apartments and a street life that was pretty unsavory. There was street crime, mobsters, and tax fraud. She grew up all around that stuff. But when Hohleder was 17, her family would be at the center of a crime that became international news.
In Europe, the kidnappers of beer millionaire Freddie Heineken today made their first demand, silence from the police, Heineken's family, or else.
Heineken and his chauffeur were abducted last night as Heineken left his office.
Almost four decades later, Astrid Hohleder is still living in the aftermath of that crime. Patrick Radden-Keefe interviewed her for the Radio Hour in 2018, and he had to be picked up in a car and taken to a secret location. We've altered her voice in our story to protect her safety. Here's Patrick.
The kidnapping of Alfred Heineken, who everyone called Freddie, the magnate who ran the Heineken company, one of the richest men in the Netherlands, was news throughout the world. Heineken walked out of his office one cold day, and as he was about to get in his car, masked gunmen pulled up in a minivan, grabbed Heineken and his chauffeur, and drove off.
Freddie Heineken, hij is voorzitter van de raad van bestuur van de brouwerij, en zijn chauffeur zijn vanavond ontvoerd. Rond 7 uur zijn ze in het centrum van Amsterdam door onbekende gemaskerde mannen.
No one was more riveted by this crime than the Hohleder family. Astrid actually remembers talking with her brother Willem, who was something of a local hoodlum himself.
I was sitting with him, eating with him, having dinner, and telling him, well, who's going to kidnap Heineken? You must be crazy because this man is a friend of the royal family. He has like so much power. They will not get away from this. And I was telling him that. And he was like, oh, do you really think so? Do you think they can't get away with it? And I'm, yes, sure. Who could be so stupid?
The thing is that their father, Willem Sr., worked for Heineken.
He was driving the trucks with beers on it, like a beer glass of 3 feet high or something. So we grew up with Mr. Heineken. We grew up with the company. He admired him so much. He would do anything for him.
Their whole life was Heineken.
Like everything in our house was drenched with the company. We ate from plates from the company. We had pencils and pens from the company. We had like balloons from the company. We played with the balloons from the company. So we also enjoyed the beer of Mr. Heineken very, very much. My father was an alcoholic, but he was very cruel.
The violence in the neighborhood was nothing compared to what Astrid and her siblings were experiencing at home.
coming home drunk, drinking all day, all night, and yelling at us, beating us up, beating my mother up. We never knew what to expect because there was no logic. It could just be because I put like my hand on the wrong side of the chair. That would be enough to receive a beating.
There were four of them. Astrid, who was fiercely independent. There was Sonia, who her mother described as a doll. She's very put together. There was their little brother, Erard, the baby of the family. And then there was Willem, the eldest, who, from his teens, started getting involved in the criminal world around him. He did this with his best friend, Cornelius van Hout, who everyone knew as Cor. They were really close. Cor actually started dating their sister, Sonia, when she was in her teens.
Well, Cor was like, he has what I call, and what we all lack in our family, has joie de vivre. When things were bad, he would always see the bright side. Another thing that struck me is that he didn't seem to be afraid of my father. And that was something that I was impressed about.
Astrid admired Cor, and she liked him. And she identified with her brother Willem, the tough guy. She related to him.
I think that if I would have been a boy, then I probably would have been the right hand of my brother. Yes. Because I have the same anger inside me. I have the same aggression inside me. And I was very ambitious. And I think my brother is also very ambitious. And because I'm a girl, you could never take part of anything to anything. So you were just a girl. And I had to look for other opportunities. His criminal career started with robberies. And those were like also spectacular robberies with speedboats and, you know, going through the canals of Amsterdam and then going through the water on the Eye, the lake. And there were a huge amount of money that they laid their hands on, like millions.
But the kidnapping of Freddie Heineken was on a whole different level. It was so well executed that for weeks, the police had no idea where to look. Desperate, the Heineken family wound up paying a massive ransom, the equivalent of about $35 million today. Eventually, the police got a tip-off, and they found Heineken and his chauffeur. They were also tipped off that Cor and Wim were behind the operation. But when they went to Cor's house to arrest him, they found Astrid and Sonia there instead. The sisters were dumbfounded. They had had no idea.
I never expected him to have done that.
So you had no inkling. You didn't even have any sense at all that your brother, even you knew that he was involved in crime, but you didn't think he would do something like this.
No.
One of Astrid's biggest concerns when the police took her in for questioning was that she was going to miss her German exam. It just didn't compute for her, the idea that her own brother had kidnapped their father's boss. The Heineken kidnapping was kind of an ingenious plot. Cor and Wim had been planning with several associates for more than a year. They built a series of soundproofed cells hidden in a warehouse on the outskirts of Amsterdam. They devised a coded system for communicating with the police and the press. And by the time the police came, they'd already fled the country with millions of dollars in ransom money.
A lot of people commit crimes. I know, you know, it's something that happens. It's part of society. But it's never that close. And with Wim, everybody he has a connection to, he turns around and then he commits a crime towards them. And I think that started with Mr. Heineken.
Willem and Cor weren't at large for long. After a couple of months, they were captured in Paris at an apartment they were staying at in a posh area near the Champs-Élysées.
Het resultaat, Van Hout en Holleder krijgen van de Fransen huisarrest en slijten hun dagen in hotels. Daar ontvangen ze de pers.
When they were arrested, there were so many questions unanswered.
Petter de Vries was a crime reporter for The Telegraph at the time, and he followed the whole thing very closely.
So I was anxious to know what happened, how they prepared everything, how they did it. And so I contacted Cor van Hout. I wanted to write a book inside the kitchen of the criminals from the point of view of the people who did it, the kidnappers.
Wim and Cor were giving interviews. They were stuck in a kind of legal limbo in France, and their fame started to grow. There were these young, cocksure, kind of arrogant guys from the streets of Amsterdam who'd had the nerve to kidnap the richest man in the country. They cut a dashing profile.
A lot of people were surprised that a criminal can also be a person with humor, common sense, and stuff like that.
Pedro de Vries ended up writing this book called Kidnapping Mr. Heineken. It was a huge bestseller. This is the kind of book that people in Amsterdam who don't read books have read this book. Everybody knew the story of Cor and Wim. Cor and Wim were eventually extradited from France to the Netherlands, and they were tried and convicted and sentenced to 11 years in prison. But they ended up serving only 5. And when they got out, they were like celebrity criminals. Not only that, but the authorities had never been able to recover all of the ransom money. So with the help of some of their criminal associates, Wim and Cor had actually invested some of this money while they were in prison.
They bought like real estate in the red light district in Amsterdam. So they bought all kinds of prostitution there. They bought like the gambling halls. They bought Casa Rosso. That's also like a, gives live sexual live shows. The banana bar, it's a bar where women shoot bananas with their private parts. And that's where a lot of tourists come and watch. I mean that's, they bought it, yes. They had apartments, they had beautiful cars, not in their names, of course. It was all in names of other people, but they didn't have to work. It's not that you could see remorse or poverty or whatever. No, it then the life started. The vacations, the house in Spain, all those kind of things.
Astrid remembers this as a relatively happy time. With their father long since out of the picture, Wim had assumed the role of the family patriarch. Cor and Wim were still partners in crime and best friends. Cor and Sonia had a second child. Astrid had gone to law school. So there was a kind of tentative harmony of the different elements in what was really a crime family.
Our families were always together. My sister had a house and we would all eat there. My brother, me, my other brother, my mother, Cor, you know. So we had one big family. And we thought everything went well.
After university, Astrid had tried to get a job in corporate law. But the Hollader name was notorious. When she went out for job interviews, nobody wanted to hire a Hollader. Wim suggested she meet with some of the criminal defense attorneys he knew. They were excited to talk with her. Being the sister of Willem Hollader had cachet. So she became a criminal lawyer. And it turned out she was really good at it.
I understood my clients. I understood the mothers. I understood the sisters that were arrested too, while they even didn't even know why. I understood the children. So to me, criminal law was, yeah, it was me.
As her career took off, Wim began to confide in Astrid. He would tell her about things he was doing, tell her about his fears. She wasn't formally his lawyer, but she did act as a kind of legal advisor, an informal sounding board.
So you, during this time, you had gone to law school. You had become quite a high-powered criminal attorney with connections throughout the city and the country. You're obviously a very formidable, smart personality. And yet you talk about kind of being under the thumb of your brother during this time. Looking back, like, how do you make sense of that?
First of all, I was his little sister. And in that sense, he was always older than I was. So he was always trying to be and remind me of the fact that he was older and I had to respect him. I was trying to give him the legal advice that would prohibit him from undertaking certain actions. Like when he was planning to shoot a rocket into somebody's house, I have to remind him that I think about him only, not about the victim he's planning to make. So that's why I advise him that he shouldn't do that, because if he would have used a rocket, that it would have been an enemy of the state. So I would advise him, don't do that, you know? But it was difficult. You don't want anybody to get hurt, but you also have to be careful not to get hurt yourself.
And it was all too easy to get hurt. One day in 1996, an assassin opened fire at Kaur as he sat in his car with his family right outside their home.
They were sitting in the car, and then a guy walked up to the car and shot through the window, and he hit Kaur. And my sister, she opened the door, rolled out of the car, and grabbed my nephew, who was sitting in the back singing a song at that time, and took him into the house. And Kaur was hit several times, but he survived.
Initially, there was just panic and confusion. When Kaur got out of the hospital, he and the family fled the country and went into hiding in a farmhouse in the woods in France. Vim promised he'd get to the bottom of things. After some investigation, he came back and he said, I figured out who wants you dead. It's these two rival gangsters. They want to kill you, and they say that unless you pay them a huge sum of money, they're going to. This seemed believable. What was strange about it to Kaur was that Vim said, I think you should just pay them. Kaur himself was no stranger to extortion, but generally he was the guy doing the extorting. So in this instance, he said, I'm not going to be extorted. I'm not going to pay the money. And this was the beginning of a real wedge between the two friends.
And then it all started. Vim was trying to force me to tell him where Kaur was. And that went on for a long period. And that was really awful because it terrorized us.
Vim wouldn't let it go. He'd ask Astrid and Sonia for information about where Kaur was hiding, and they were reluctant to tell him. Over a period of time, an awful suspicion began to occur to the sisters. What if it hadn't been these gangsters who had ordered the killing?
Then in the end, there was a second attempt, and Kaur did survive again. And then there was a third time, and that was final.
After Kaur was killed, the family gathered together, and Vim came, and he comforted his sisters. But by this point, they were pretty certain that he was the man responsible for Kaur's death.
We were all three of us sitting on the couch, and he was in the middle, and he was grabbing us by the shoulders and pulling us towards him. And I'm like looking at my sister, and my sister's looking at me, knowing that this is all fake. And knowing you have to just undergo this, because if you do otherwise, you would accuse him. And if you would accuse him, then he would probably kill us too. So there was not much of a choice.
Astrid Holleder talking about her brother, Willem. We'll continue in a moment with this story from Patrick Radden-Keefe. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs, because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. In 2018, Patrick Radden-Keefe told us the story of Astrid Holleder, whose brother Willem Holleder, known as Wim, was one of Europe's most notorious gangsters. So we're listening to that story now. Astrid knew about her brother Willem's activities. They were close, and she was a lawyer. So he'd get advice from her. But then their close friend and brother-in-law, Cor, was killed after several attempts on his life. More of Willem's associates started to disappear, and Astrid realized that she was very much in danger herself. So how could she get out of it? Here's Patrick Radden-Keefe to finish the story.
Just as Astrid was coming to realize what her brother was capable of, the rest of the country was falling for him. Wim started writing a column for a local newspaper. He was featured on a hip-hop single called Willem Is Back.
Hey, Lange. Zeg je uit, Wim.
Ik heb wat dingetjes gedaan, ja, je hebt het vastgelezen. 21 jaren van mijn leven vastgezeten. En het komt door niets spreken. Ik ben een ouderwets. Ik haal mijn rug rechter dan die mooie oude west.
He even appeared on a national talk show called College Tour.
U bedankt voor het kijken thuis. En Willem Holleder voor uw aanwezigheid hier in deze zaal. Dank u wel.
Bedankt.
Dank u wel.
People would see Willem around Amsterdam riding his scooter, and he became this well-known, kind of iconic figure. They started referring to him in the Dutch press as the cuddly criminal. People would come up to him on the street and ask for selfies. Meanwhile, his associates in the underworld started dying one by one. And with Cor dead, Astrid and Sonja were terrified for their children. Astrid's daughter, Miljuschka, and Sonja's children, Francis and Richie.
It's always a question, is he going to do anything to the kids or not? We were two women with children and had to, yeah, survive. So that's what we did. You feel hypocrite. From the day on that happened, it was a feeling as if I betrayed Cor, betrayed myself, because I just acted the way he wanted, not having the guts to go to the police or anything. So, yeah, that was the start of feeling dirty.
No one was arrested in connection with Cor's death. Wim, for his part, was suspected pretty widely of involvement in a great many murders, but he was never charged. He could seem almost above the law, immune, zipping around on his scooter and palling around with local celebrities. But privately, he was becoming more erratic. Eventually, crime journalist Petter de Vries found himself in Wim's sights. Petter's popular book about the Heineken kidnapping, which was a big bestseller, had been picked up by an American production company.
That is the way the game is played.
You know how big this thing is.
He's insane. Or he's smart.
But before the movie came out, Holleder turned on him.
He said, I don't want to have my name mentioned in this picture. And at that time, he came to my house in the evening at 10 o'clock. And then the doorbell rang. And when I looked out of the window, I saw, hey, that's Willem Holleder. And I said to my wife, I don't think this is okay. He was on his motorbike. He had his helmet on. He had a big leather jacket on, gloves, big shoes. And he is quite an impressive guy, even without these clothes. And I immediately saw that he was fucked up, and he was, when I opened the door and I said, hey, Willem, he started yelling at me. And at that time, I was thinking, oh, in 30 seconds, I will be lying on the ground fighting for my life.
But Petter de Vries is a bit of a tough guy himself, and he's a seasoned crime reporter, so he managed to keep his wits about him.
I said, Willem, calm down. Let's just talk. What's the problem? And now he finally calmed down a little bit and he seemed to leave. About three times he also returned to me, standing again very close to me, and, "Do I have to do it right now? You know what is going to happen. You can call the police, but it won't help you." But finally, after three times, he went away, and that was it.
Petter did call the police. He filed a police report. But in the meantime, Astrid had started talking to the authorities too.
I couldn't live on with the thought that he would kill again. So that's when I turned on him. The only thing we would have left if we wouldn't go to police was take the rights into our own hand and shoot him. And I must say that would have been the best solution for him and for me. But my daughter didn't want me to. My daughter didn't want to have a mother, a killer for a mother.
She started to tell the police some of what she knew. But the whole process filled her with terror. What if Vim found out? What if she had to testify in court, but there wasn't enough evidence to send him away? She was a criminal defense attorney, remember. She knew what kind of evidence she would need. So she decided to wear a wire.
That in itself was an adventure, because at one point I thought I had a really good one, and I had it stuck between the front of my bra. At one point, we were talking, and I felt that it was sliding. So I felt it fell down, and I was with him. So if it would fall on the ground, I mean, he would have noticed that. He would kill me immediately. So there were times that I was really, really afraid, and I kept on being afraid.
Astrid eventually compiled hundreds of hours of recordings. And she persuaded Sonia to record conversations with Vim also. The first time I heard these recordings, they gave me a shiver. You listen to them and you can hear, just in the tone of his voice, the kind of figure this guy was in his family. He was a figure of terror.
Mensen die dingen tegen mij gaan verklaren om mij van de straat af te halen. Jij bent alleen maar mijn stoorzender in mijn hele leven. Kankeroe, ik heb alleen ellende van je. Je familie van Cor, iedereen.
Willem was finally arrested in 2014 and charged with involvement in half a dozen murders, including the murder of Cor van Hout more than a decade earlier. Her brother is in police custody now, but Astrid isn't safe. In 2016, a gang member being held in the same prison told authorities that Willem had tried to hire him to murder Astrid, Sonia, and Petter de Vries.
What will you do in the admittedly very slim chance that he's not convicted?
Then he would go after me, and I would go after him. I'm not going to sit around and wait till he is killing everybody.
Astrid shuttles around the city in armored vehicles. She wears disguises, and she lives in a series of safe houses. When I went to see her, I would be told to wait by a particular canal in Amsterdam, and a driver would show up, then take me to an undisclosed location. I never knew where I was going. It was never to her apartment.
I'm living in places that are furnished. It's always being in somebody else's house. So that's different. I'm like 52, but I don't really have a place of my own.
When she testifies in Vim's trial, she sits behind a screen. She doesn't want anybody to see her. But also, the prosecutors don't want her to be able to see Vim. So she's behind the screen, yet her voice fills the courtroom. And the two of them bicker and argue. They shout at each other at times. It's incredibly tense. If Willem is convicted, he'll probably be held in a maximum security prison until he dies. But even then, Astrid won't feel safe. I asked her why, and she said that if he gets a life sentence, her brother will have nothing to think about for the rest of his life but revenge. Like Willem, Astrid has become a celebrity in the Netherlands. She wrote a book called Judas about how she turned him in. Think about that title. She doesn't see herself as a hero for stopping this murder spree. She sees herself as Willem's betrayer.
I think it's awful what I do to him, because he will be in prison for life. So thinking about that, being the person that sends him away for life, well, that's an agony every day. If I think about the moment he must have heard that I was the one who testified against him, that must have been such a shock. And later on, he did say in court how it felt for him to hear about us, especially me, testifying against him. Yeah.
Watching the trial, what struck me the most was that despite the incredibly raw conflict between these two siblings, as brother and sister, they still share a powerful bond. That having grown up in this abusive environment, Astrid feels, despite it all, incredibly connected with her brother.
I keep thinking about all the factors of our childhood. I'm like, well, it could have been me, you know, if I would have been a boy. It could have been me.
If you could talk to your brother, if it were just the two of you today, now, together, not in the courtroom, what would you say to him?
Oh. Whoa. That I still love him in spite of everything. That I wish I could take him home. That he could be a brother to me. And, that I could take him home.
Willem Holleder was sentenced to life in prison in connection with five murders. Astrid Holleder spoke with staff writer Patrick Radden-Keefe in 2018, and her story is told in Patrick's new collection of reporting, a book called Rogues. And 1 year ago, the reporter Petter de Vries, who was interviewed for our story, was killed. He was shot while leaving a TV studio. And the two suspects are believed to be affiliated with an organized crime group that de Vries was investigating. Their trial began last month. That's the New Yorker Radio Hour for today. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, and Gofen Mputubwele, with help from Allison McAdam, David Gable, Harrison Keithline, Alex Barish, Victor Guan, and Mengfei Chen.
We had additional help this week from Michael May.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.